And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, December 23rd, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today is our sporadically annual Christmas show, and we read some of our favorite Christmas stories and poems. And with me in the studio are writers Jill Amadio and Michael Conlon, and accompanying us on guitar is Travis Barrett. Hello, you guys.
Hi.
So,
Merry Christmas.
Well, we have so much to read today, and we have music and so much going on, but and this is live, so any flubs, all of you out there, I hope you'll bear with us, because as I said, this is live and pretty much unrehearsed. So it'll be fun. So we're going to begin with Mike Conlon reading a piece. He's going to tell us what he's going to read, then he's going to read it.
All right, thanks, Barbara. As the oldest child of five, and I'm 7 years older than my other siblings, my greatest Christmas memory was not of arriving in the morning for our presents, but actually the first time I was old enough to be invited by my dad into the garage on Christmas Eve, to help construct the presents after my brothers and sisters had gone to bed. So I found the story by Pearl Buck, author of The Good Earth, and it reminded me of this bonding that I had with my father at that time. It's called Christmas Day in the Morning. He woke suddenly and completely. It was 4 o'clock, the hour at which his father had always called him to get up and help with the milking. Strange how the habits of his youth clung to him still. 50 years ago, when his father had been dead for 30 years, and yet he waked at 4 o'clock in the morning. He had trained himself to turn over and go to sleep, but this morning it was Christmas. He did not try to sleep. Why did he feel so awake tonight? He slipped back in time, as he did so easily nowadays. He was 15 years old and still on his father's farm. He loved his father. He had not known it until one day, a few days before Christmas, when he had overheard what his father was saying to his mother. "Mary, I hate to call Rob in the mornings. He's growing so fast and he needs his sleep. If you could see how he sleeps when I go in to wake him up, I wish I could manage alone." "Well, you can't, Adam." His mother's voice was brisk. "He isn't a child anymore. It's his time. It's time he took his turn." "Yes," his father said slowly, "but I sure do hate to wake him." When he heard these words, something in him spoke. His father loved him. He had never thought of that before, taking for granted the tie of their blood. Neither his father nor his mother talked about loving their children. They had no time for such things. There was always so much to do on the farm. Now that he knew his father loved him, there would be no loitering in the mornings or having to be called again. He got up after that, stumbling blindly in his sleep, and pulled on his clothes, his eyes shut, but he got up. And then on the night before Christmas, that year when he was 15, he lay for a few minutes thinking about the next day. They were poor, and most of the excitement was in the turkey they had raised themselves and mince pies his mother made. His sisters sewed presents, and his mother and father always bought him something he needed, not only a warm jacket, maybe, but something more, such as a book. And he saved and bought them each something, too. He wished that Christmas, when he was 15, he had a better present for his father. As usual, he had gone to the 10-cent store and bought a tie. It had seemed nice enough until he lay thinking the night before Christmas. He looked out his attic window. The stars were bright. "Dad," he had once asked when he was a little boy, "what is a stable?" "It's just a barn," his father had replied, "like ours." And Jesus had been born in a barn, and to a barn the shepherds had come. The thought struck him like a silver dagger. Why should he not give his father a special gift too, out there in the barn? He could get up early, earlier than 4 o'clock, and he could creep into the barn and get all the milking done. He'd do it alone, milk and clean up. And then, when his father went in to start the milking, he'd see it all done. And he would know who had done it. He laughed to himself as he gazed at the stars. It was what he would do, and he mustn't sleep too sound. He must have waked 20 times, scratching a match each time to look at his old watch. Midnight and half past one, and then 2 o'clock. At 2:45, he got up and put on his clothes. He crept downstairs, careful of the creaky boards, and let himself out. The cows looked at him, sleepy and surprised. It was really for them, too. He had never milked all alone before, but it seemed almost easy. He kept thinking about his father's surprise. His father would come in and get him, saying that he would get things started while Rob was getting dressed. He'd go to the barn, open the door, and then he'd go get the 2 big empty milk cans. But they wouldn't be waiting or empty. They'd be standing in the milk house, filled. "What the?" he could hear his father exclaiming. He smiled and milked steadily, 2 strong streams rushing into the pail, frothing and fragrant. The task went more easily than he had ever known it go before. Milking for once was not a chore, it was something else, a gift to his father who loved him. He finished. The 2 milk cans were full, and he covered them and closed the milk house door carefully, making sure of the latch. Back in his room, he had only a minute to pull off his clothes in the darkness and jump into bed, for he heard his father up. He put the covers over his head to silence his quick breathing. The door opened. "Rob," his father called. "We have to get up, son, even if it's Christmas." "All right," he said sleepily. The door closed, and he lay still, laughing to himself. In just a few minutes, his father would know. His dancing heart was ready to jump from his body. The minutes were endless, 10, 15, he did not know how many, but he heard his father's footsteps again. The door opened, and he lay still. "Rob!" "Yes, Dad?" His father was laughing, a queer, sobbing sort of laugh. "Thought you'd fool me, did you?" His father was standing by his bed, feeling for him, pulling away the cover. "It's for Christmas, Dad." He found his father and clutched him in a great hug. He felt his father's arms go around him. It was dark, and they could not see each other's faces. "Son, I thank you. Nobody ever did a nicer thing." Dad, I want you to know I do want to be good." The words broke from him of their own will. He did not know what to say. His heart was bursting with love. He got up and pulled on the clothes again, and they went down to the Christmas tree. Oh, what a Christmas, and how his heart had nearly burst again with shyness and pride as his father told his mother and made the younger children listen about how he, Rob, had got up all by himself. "The best Christmas I ever had, and I'll remember it, son, every year on Christmas morning, so long as I live." They had both remembered it, and now that his father was dead, he remembered it alone. That blessed Christmas dawn when, alone with the cows in the barn, he had made his first gift of true love. This Christmas, he wanted to write a card to his wife to tell her how much he loved her. It had been a long time since he had really told her, although he loved her in a very special way, much more than he ever had when they were young. He had been fortunate that she had loved him. Ah, there is the true joy of life, the ability to love. Love was still alive in him. It still was. It occurred to him suddenly that it was alive because long ago it had been born in him when he knew his father loved him. That was it. Love alone could awaken love. And he could give the gift again and again. This morning, this blessed Christmas morning, he would give it to his beloved wife. He could write it down in a letter for her to read and keep forever. He went to his desk and began his love letter to his wife. "My dearest love, such a happy, happy Christmas."
Christmas time is here, happiness and cheer fun for all that children call their favorite time of year. Snowflakes in the air, carols everywhere, olden times and ancient rhymes of love and dreams to share. Sleigh bells in the air, beauty everywhere, Yuletide by the fireside, and joyful memories there. Christmas time is here, families growing near. Oh, that we could always see such spirit through the year. Sleigh bells in the everywhere, Yuletide by the fireside, and joyful memories there. Christmas time is here, families growing near. Oh, that we could always see such spirit through the year. Oh, that we could always see such spirit through.
I just came back from a lovely trip along the Milky Way. I stopped off at the North Pole to spend...
And welcome back to Writers on Writing. Well, actually, we never really left, but we have a lot of things going on in here. So, Jill, what are you going to read to us?
I'm going to read The Boy Who Laughed at Santa Claus. It's by Ogden Nash, the humorist.
Okay.
In Baltimore there lived a boy. He wasn't anybody's joy. Although his name was Jabez Dawes, his character was full of flaws. In school he never led his classes. He hid old ladies' reading glasses. His mouth was open when he chewed, and elbows to the table glued. He stole the milk of hungry kittens and walked through doors marked "No Admittance." He said he acted thus because there wasn't any Santa Claus. Another trick that tickled Jabez was crying boo at little babies. He brushed his teeth, they said in town, sideways instead of up and down. Yet people pardoned every sin and viewed his antics with a grin. Till they were told by Jabez Dawes, there isn't any Santa Claus. Deploring how he did behave, his parents swiftly sought their grave. They hurried through the portals pearly, and Jabez left the funeral early. Like whooping cough from child to child, he sped to spread the rumour wild. Same as my name is Jabez Dawes, there isn't any Santa Claus. Slunk like a weasel or a marten through nursery and kindergarten, whispering low to every tot, there isn't any, no, there's not. The children wept all Christmas Eve, and Jabez chortled up his sleeve. No infant dared to hang up his stocking, for fear of Jabez's ribald mocking. He sprawled on his untidy bed, fresh malice dancing in his head. When presently, with scalp a-tingling, Jabez heard a distant jingling. He heard the crunch of sleigh and hoof, crisply a-righting on the roof. What good to rise and bar the door? A shower of soot was on the floor. What was beheld by Jabez Dawes? The fireplace full of Santa Claus. Then Jabez fell upon his knees with cries of don't, and pretty pleased he howled, I don't know where you read it, but anyhow I never said it. Jabez replied the angry saint, it isn't I, it's you that ain't. Although there is a Santa Claus, there isn't any Jabez Dawes. Said Jabez with impudent vim, oh yes there is, and I am him. Your magic doesn't scare me, it doesn't. And suddenly he found he wasn't. From grimy feet to grimy locks, Jabez became a jack-in-the-box, an ugly toy with springs unsprung, forever sticking out his tongue. The neighbors heard his mournful squeal. They searched for him, but not with zeal. No trace was found of Jabez Dawes, which led to thunderous applause, and people drank a loving cup and went and hung their stockings up. All you who sneer at Santa Claus, beware the fate of Jabez Dawes, the saucy boy who mocked the saint. Donner and Blitzen licked off his paint.
To the moon. that must come from within. And I've looked for the love that will bring me to rest, feeding this heart beating strong in my chest, feeding this hunger beating strong in my chest. Just get me through December, promise I'll remember. Get me through December so I can start again.
All right. I am going to read The Gifts of the Magi, and Mike may pick it up at some point during. We'll see how it goes. If I start coughing, I'm out of here. All right. And I read this story every year, either to myself, with the family. I just love this story. I think it's my favorite O. Henry story. $1.87. That was all. And 60 cents of it was in pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by bulldozing the grocer and the vegetable man and the butcher until one's cheeks burned with the silent imputation of parsimony that such close dealing implied. Three times Della counted it, $1.87, and the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but flop down on the shabby little couch and howl. So Della did it, which instigates the moral reflection that life is made up of sobs, sniffles, and smiles, with sniffles predominating. While the mistress of the home is gradually subsiding from the first stage to the second, take a look at the home, a furnished flat at $8 per week. It did not exactly beggar description, but it certainly had that word on the lookout for the mendicancy squad. In the vestibule below belonged to this flat a letterbox into which no letter would go, and an electric button from which no mortal finger could coax a ring. Also appertaining thereunto was a card bearing the name Mr. James Dillingham Young. The Dillingham had been flung to the breeze during a former period of prosperity when its possessor was being paid $30 per week. Now, when the income was shrunk to $20, the letters of Dillingham looked blurred, as though they were thinking seriously of contracting to a modest and unassuming D. But whenever Mr. James Dillingham Young came home and reached his flat above, he was called Jim and greatly hugged by Mrs. James Dillingham Young, already introduced to you as Della, which is all very good. Della finished her cry and attended to her cheeks with the powder rag. She stood by the window and looked out dully at a gray cat walking a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day, and she had only $1.87 with which to buy Jim a present. She had been saving every penny she could for months with this result. $20 a week doesn't go far. Expenses had been greater than she had calculated. They always are. Only $1.87 to buy a present for Jim. Her Jim. Many a happy hour she had spent planning for something nice for him. Something fine and rare and sterling. Something just a little bit near to being worthy of the honor of being Jim's wife. There was a pier glass between the windows of the room. Perhaps you have seen a pier glass in an $8 flat. A very thin and very agile person may, by observing his reflection in a rapid sequence of longitudinal strips, obtain a fairly accurate conception of his looks. Della, being slender, had mastered the art. Suddenly, she whirled from the window and stood before the glass. Her eyes were shining brilliantly, but her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Rapidly, she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, there were two possessions of the James Dillingham Youngs in which they both took a mighty pride. One was Jim's gold watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in the flat across the air shaft, Della would have let her hair hang out the window someday to dry and mocked Her Majesty's jewels and gifts. Had King Solomon been the janitor with all his treasures piled up in the basement, Jim would have pulled out his watch every time he passed, just to see him pluck at his beard from envy. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her, rippling and shining like a cascade of brown waters. It reached below her knee and made itself almost a garment for her. And then she did it up again nervously and quickly. Once she faltered for a minute and stood still while a tear or two splashed on the worn red carpet. On went her old brown jacket, on went her old brown hat. With a whirl of skirts and with the brilliant sparkle still in her eyes, she fluttered out the door and down the stairs to the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofronie, hair goods of all kinds. One flight up, Della ran and collected herself, panting, before Madame, large, too white, chilly, and hardly looking the Sofronie. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della. I buy hair, said Madame. Take off your hat. Let's have a sight of the looks of it. Down rippled the brown cascade. $20, said Madame, lifting the mass with a practiced hand. Give it to me quick, said Della. Oh, and the next 2 hours tripped by on rosy wings. Forget the hashed metaphor. She was ransacking the stores for Jim's present. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. There was none other like it in any of the stores, and she had turned all of them inside out. It was a platinum fob chain, simple and chaste in design, properly proclaiming its value by substance alone and not by meretricious ornamentation, as all good things should do. It was even worthy of the watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be Jim's. It was like him. Quietness and value. The description applied to both. $21 they took from her for it, and she hurried home with the 87 cents. With that chain on his watch, Jim might be properly anxious about the time in any company. Grand as the watch was, he sometimes looked at it on the slide on account of the old leather strap that he used in place of a chain. When Della reached home, her intoxication gave way to a little prudence and reason. She got out her curling irons and lighted the gas and went to work repairing the ravages made by generosity added to love. Which is always a tremendous task, dear friends, a mammoth task. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny, close-lying curls that made her look wonderfully like a truant schoolboy. She looked at her reflection in the mirror long, carefully, and critically. If Jim doesn't kill me, she said to herself, before he takes a second look at me, he'll say I look like a Coney Island chorus girl. But what could I do? What could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock, the coffee was made and the frying pan was on the back of the stove, hot and ready to cook the chops. Jim was never late. Della doubled the fob chain in her hand and sat on the corner of the table near the door that he always entered. Then she heard his step on the stair away down on the first flight, and she turned white for just a moment. She had a habit of saying little silent prayers about the simplest everyday things, and now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I am still pretty." The door opened, and Jim stepped in and closed it. He looked thin and very serious. Poor fellow, he was only 22, and to be burdened with a family. He needed a new overcoat, and he was without gloves. Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a setter at the scent of a quail. His eyes were fixed upon Della, and there was an expression in them that she could not read, and it terrified her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor disapproval, nor horror, nor any of the sentiments that she had been prepared for. He simply stared at her fixedly with that peculiar expression on his face. Della wriggled off the table and went for him. "Jim, darling," she cried, "don't look at me that way. I had my hair cut off and sold it because I couldn't have lived with it through Christmas without giving you a present. It'll grow again. You won't mind, will you? I just had to do it. My hair grows awfully fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let's be happy. You don't know what a beautiful, nice gift I've got for you." "You've cut off your hair?" asked Jim, laboriously, as if he had not arrived at that patent fact yet, even after the hardest mental labor. "Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Don't you like me just as well anyhow? I'm me without my hair, ain't I?" Jim looked about the room curiously. "You say your hair is gone?" he said, with an air almost of idiocy. "You needn't look for it," said Della. "It's sold, I tell you, sold and gone, too. It's Christmas Eve, boy. Be good to me, for it went for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered," she went on with a sudden serious sweetness, "but nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the chops on, Jim?" Out of his trance, Jim seemed to quickly wake. He enfolded his Della. For 10 seconds, let us regard with discreet scrutiny some inconsequential object in the other direction. $8 a week or $1 million a year, what is the difference? A mathematician or a wit would give you the wrong answer. The Magi brought valuable gifts, but that was not among them. This dark assertion will be illuminated later on. Jim drew a package from his overcoat pocket and threw it upon the table. "Don't make any mistake, Del," he said, "about me. I don't think there's anything in the way of a haircut or a shave or a shampoo that could make me like my girl any less. But if you'll unwrap that package, you may see why you had me going a while at first." White fingers and nimble tore at the string and paper, and then an ecstatic scream of joy, and then, alas, a quick feminine change to hysterical tears and wails, necessitating the immediate employment of all the comforting powers of the Lord of the Flat. For there lay the combs, the set of combs, side and back, that Della had worshipped for long in a Broadway window. Beautiful combs, pure tortoiseshell with jeweled rims, just the shade to wear in the beautiful vanished hair. They were expensive combs, she knew, and her heart had simply craved and yearned over them without the least hope of possession. And now they were hers, but the tresses that should have adorned the coveted adornments were gone. But she hugged them to her bosom, and at length she was able to look up with dim eyes and then a smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." And then Della leaped up like a singed cat and cried, "Oh, oh." Jim had not seen his beautiful present. She held it out to him eagerly upon her open palm. The dull, precious metal seemed to flash with a reflection of her bright and ardent spirit. "Isn't it a dandy, Jim? I hunted all over town to find it. You'll have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim tumbled down on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Del," he said, "let's put our Christmas presents away and keep them a while. They're too nice to use just at present. I sold the watch to get the money to buy your combs. And now suppose you put the chops on." The Magi, as you know, were wise men, wonderfully wise men who brought gifts to the babe in the manger. They invented the art of giving Christmas gifts. Being wise, their gifts were no doubt wise ones, possibly bearing the privilege of exchange in case of duplication. And here I have lamely related to you the uneventful chronicle of 2 foolish children in a flat who most unwisely sacrificed for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these 2 were the wisest. Of all who give and receive gifts, such as they are wisest. Everywhere they are wisest. They are the Magi.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree. Christmas Eve will find me where the love light gleams. I'll be home for Christmas. If only in my dream.
All right, Jill has something for us. Oh, sorry, Mike. Mike has something for us. What are you going to read?
Okay. Well, as I was looking for some poems, I felt I wanted to try and find something that fit where we are. Most Christmas stories seem to be perfectly set in Germany or England or something like that, and Southern California often gets lost out. And also, you know, it's a Christian holiday, but you know, in Southern California, we have all sorts of people living here, from Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Muslims. And I happened to find this poem earlier that I thought was closer to what our experience is here in the Southland. This is called Toward the Winter Solstice. It's a poem by Timothy Steele. Although the roof is just a story high, it dizzies me a little to look down. I lariat twirl the rope of Christmas lights and cast it to the weeping birch's crown. A dowel into which I've screwed a hook enables me to reach, lift, drape, and twine the cord among the boughs so that the bulbs will accent the tree's elegant design. Friends passing home from work or shopping pause, and they call up commendations or critiques. I make adjustments, though a potpourri of Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Jews, and Sikhs, we are all conscious of the time of year. We all enjoy its colorful displays and keep some festival that mitigates the dwindling warmth and compass of the days. Some say that L.A. doesn't suit the Yule, but UPS vans, now like magi, make their present-laden rounds, while fallen leaves are gaily resurrected in their wake. The desert lifts a full moon from the east and issues a dry Santa Ana breeze, and valets at chic restaurants will soon be tending flocks of cars and SUVs. And as neighborhoods sink into dusk, the fan palms scattered all across the town stand more calmly prominent, and this place seems a vast oasis in the Holy Land. This house might be a caravansary, a tree, a kind of cordial fountainhood of welcome, looped and decked with necklaces and censures of green, yellow, blue, and red. Some wonder if the Star of Bethlehem occurred when Jupiter and Saturn crossed. It's comforting to look up from this roof and feel that while all changes, nothing's lost. To recollect that in antiquity, the winter solstice fell in Capricorn, and that in the Orion Nebula, from swirling gas, new stars are being born.
I really can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
The evening has been
hoping that you drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hand, said she.
just like
my mother will start to worry.
Beautiful, what's your hurry?
Father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace.
So really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't hurry.
Maybe just to have a drink more.
Put some records on while I go.
Neighbors might think
maybe it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this drink?
No caps to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Your eyes are like starlight.
All right, so I believe Jill is going to close out the show with The Night Before Christmas, and you have some trivia about
well, very
this.
Little, actually. It was written in 1822 by Clement Moore for his children. He wasn't much of a writer, and he's known for nothing else
except this.
This 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
And he I was think on this day it was written.
Yes,
I believe it was. 22 or 23.
22, I have. And he was actually a professor of Oriental languages.
And this is his swan song, his one-hit wonder.
Yes. Well,
swan song.
It would be nice if we all had one of those. Okay, here we go. 'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hope that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama, in her kitchen, and I in my cap, had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When, out on the lawn, there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew in a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below. When, what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, oh, come on, Cupid, on, Donner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then, in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur, from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Oh, thank you, Jill.
You're welcome.
And we have time. We have time. So Mike is going to read. What are you going to read?
Well, you brought in a poem which ironically appeared on today's Writer's Almanac on my computer.
And I printed it out, I think, from Writer's Almanac from several years ago. Interesting. I like it when that happens.
And I've never heard the poem before, but it's by one of my favorite poets. So,
Heritage.
So this is called A Christmas Poem, appropriately, by Robert Bly. Christmas is a place, like Jackson Hole, where all agree to meet once a year. It has water and grass for horses. All the fur traders can come in. We visited the place as children, but we never heard the good stories. Those stories only get told in the big tents, late at night, when a trapper who has been caught in his own trap, held down in icy water, talks. Or a man with a ponytail and a limp comes in from the edge of the fire. As children, we knew there was more to it. Why some men got drunk on Christmas Eve wasn't explained, nor why we were so often near tears, nor why the stars came down so close, why so much was lost. Those men and women who had died in wars started by others, did they come that night? Is that why the Christmas tree trembled just before we opened the presents? There was something about angels. Angels we have heard on high, sweetly singing over the plain. The angels were certain, but we cannot be certain whether our family was worthy tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. You have such a nice voice, both of you.
Thank you.
I think you both need radio shows. Okay, I'm going to, we have time for another, and maybe another if you have another, but I'm going to read a Billy Collins poem called The Christmas Sparrow, and it's in the collection Aimless Love, New and Selected Poems that I actually gave to Travis, who is playing in the background here last Christmas. Christmas Sparrow. The first thing I heard this morning was a rapid flapping sound, soft, insistent. Wings against glass, as it turned out, downstairs when I saw the small bird rioting in the frame of a high window, trying to hurl itself through the enigma of glass into the spacious light. Then a noise in the throat of the cat, who was hunkered on the rug, told me how the bird had gotten inside, carried in the cold night through the flap of a basement door, and later released from the soft grip of teeth. On a chair, I trapped its pulsations in a shirt and got it to the door, so weightless it seemed to have vanished into the nest of cloth. But outside, when I uncupped my hands, it burst into its element, dipping over the dormant garden in a spasm of wingbeats, then disappeared over a row of tall hemlocks. For the rest of the day, I could feel its wild thrumming against my palms as I wondered about the hours it must have spent pent in the shadows of that room, hidden in the spiky branches of our decorated tree, breathing there among the metallic angels, ceramic apples, stars of yarn, its eyes open like mine as I lie in bed tonight, picturing this rare, lucky sparrow tucked into a holly bush now, a light snow tumbling through the windless dark. I love that poem. Did you find something else, Mike?
I can, if you want one more.
We have time.
All right. This is kind of ironic because the last time I read this poem, I was in a survey class at UCI getting my BA in English back in 1973 or so. And we had to read all these poems by poets that were kind of stuffy. But this one, I remember liking. I read the entire poem. It's a very long one. It's called In Memoriam by Lord Alfred Tennyson. I think he was a poet laureate of England during the Gothic period, Queen Victoria and everything. I hope my professors aren't listening. And in 1833, a good friend of his, Arthur Henry Hallam, had died. And he wrote the poem basically as a dedication to Henry. But it wasn't published until 1850, so obviously he took some time and needed some time to get it finished. And there was something about Christmas that allowed him to come up with the final verses to the poem. And this is the part that he kind of comes to grip with his grief and how he deals with it. In Memoriam. Ring out, wild bells, to the wild sky. the flying cloud, the frosty light. The year is dying in the night. Ring out wild bells and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring, happy bells, across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind, for those that here we see no more. Ring out the feud of rich and poor. Ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer laws. Ring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. Ring out false pride in place and blood, the civic slander and the spite. Ring in the love of truth and right. Ring in the common love of good. Ring out old shapes of foul disease. Ring out the narrowing lust of gold. Ring out the thousand wars of old. Ring in the thousand years of peace. Ring in the valiant man and free, the larger heart, the kindlier hand. Ring out the darkness of the land. Ring in the Christ that is to be.
Love that. How long is that poem?
Many, many stanzas is all I can recall. That's from my, this is the end of it.
Interesting. I love that. And what was the title again?
In Memoriam.
Well, you two, and you three, all of you, thank you for doing the show.
Thank you
today.
For inviting us.
Of course. Maybe we'll have to make it an annual next year.
Valentine's Day,
Valentine's
Easter.
Day, Mother's Day, you know, the summer solstice. Okay. Anyway, and all of you out there, thank you for being with us. And have a wonderful Christmas, New Year's. See you in January. I think Marie will be here next week, but hopefully some of you will too. And we're going to close it out with Pavarotti. Sandy.